Hello, and welcome to ID Talk, answers from an infectious disease expert. I'm Dr. Sean Elliott, a pediatric infectious disease specialist with Tucson Medical Center, professor emeritus of pediatrics at the University of Arizona College of Medicine, and long-term contributor to infectious diseases and immunizations topics at the Arizona chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. This podcast has been created to answer questions from our chapter's members about the COVID-19 pandemic and everything else infectious disease and infection prevention related. Thank you so much for joining us, and if you're joining from outside of Arizona, thanks for tuning in as well. This is the week of April 15th. Here we are, halfway through April already, and things continue to look and feel exciting in terms of infectious diseases. Certainly, we continue to see a plateau and a decrease in the respiratory viruses out there. RSV is dwindling, but not gone yet, of course. Still seeing rhino/enterovirus, fair number of patients with adenovirus, and still occasional influenzas A's and B's as well. So definitely seeing some respiratory stuff out there. SARS coronavirus 2 has largely decreased its wintertime mini surge, and so those cases also are sporadic, thankfully sporadic at best. So today's questions cover a nice gamut of things, and again, some fabulously very interesting questions, and thank you all for sending those in. Keep them coming, because it stimulates me to sort of, wow, I'm not sure I remember that, or I need to do some digging. So it's all good, so we can grow and learn together. So question number one has to do with the current outbreak of measles in the United States, and Arizona is certainly in the top 10 states in terms of numbers of cases, still looking at the five that we're aware of and a couple other suspects. The questioner asks, I read that if a child has recently received an MMR vaccine, they may test positive for measles. What steps should we as clinicians take when reading PCR tests for patients with suspected measles? So a couple key factors behind this question, and it's an excellent one. First of all, MMR, as with the varicella vaccines, are all live attenuated vaccines. So one is actually injecting with a live virus. Now, it's attenuated so as not to cause disease, but it is going to create antigenic structures, that's the whole purpose, to drive the antibody reaction, just like any other vaccine. Those antigenic structures in the virus itself do have DNA, and DNA/RNA can be amplified by PCR constructs. So if one is testing a suspect measles case in a patient who has just been immunized for the first time with MMR, you can expect to find both an immunoglobulin M and eventually an immunoglobulin G response to the measles antigen. So that would appear to be a positive. However, that is just a appropriate and effective vaccine response. So keeping that in mind. However, the screening test, and we have the ability to do molecular diagnostics, so PCR-based testing for measles, is also potentially going to pick up the vaccine virus, the vaccine measles virus, in a small amount, and PCR constructs are very good at amplifying small amount of nuclear material. So yes, it is possible, certainly in the first, we'll say up to 2 weeks after MMR vaccine, that one could have a positive PCR test for measles, which is all due to the vaccine. How does one differentiate that finding, a false positive, from a patient who, despite having been immunized, may also have just picked up early onset measles? And it truly has to do with onset of clinical symptoms. It would be quite a reportable event for a patient to have wild type or active measles in the absence of any clinical findings whatsoever. So whereas the child who has been immunized with MMR may have a little post-vaccine fevers just because you're immunizing MMR along with a couple other vaccines, which may drive an immunologically based fever, they won't have the classic three C's of measles, that being cough, coryza, conjunctivitis. And they should not, in fact, rarely would have a measles rash. Although there have been some reports of a measles type rash, a morbilliform rash, in patients who are vaccinated. But importantly, lack of fever and three C's would argue strongly against wild type measles and for vaccine response. So steps to take as a clinician are to be aware of the patient's vaccine status, recently vaccinated, and interpret cautiously any positive findings. On the other hand, patient who is previously vaccinated, and we do know that immunity to the MMR can wane in older, certainly older adolescents, on up into young adulthood. So if you have one of those patients who may have been vaccinated, may have had an exposure to measles, and now is presenting with a compatible viral-looking illness and a positive measles test, interpret that as a suspect case and certainly get your health department involved. So thank you for asking that. It's an important clarification of how we sometimes can be fooled by still yet doing the right thing and immunizing our patients, especially when the vaccine is a live attenuated vaccine. Okay, next question. In Arizona, we've been seeing an increase in invasive serogroup Y meningococcal disease. What should healthcare providers be aware of? So yes, absolutely right. Not just in Arizona, but countrywide. Per the CDC, through March 25th, 2024, there have been 143 cases of meningococcal disease, almost all of which are due to serogroup Y. That is far greater than this time to date last year in 2023, where, you know, by March 25th or so, we had only 81 cases. So yes, there has been an increase in cases across the country. In Arizona, so far in 2024, we've had 9 documented confirmed cases of meningococcal disease, 6 of which were due to serogroup Y. Now, serogroup Y, I think that this may trigger some memories from back in the back, but the original quadrivalent meningococcal vaccine covered the serogroups A, C, Y, and W135. Then along came effective immunization against serogroup B, and we now have the quinivalent vaccines license to cover all of those. So serogroup Y is just one of 5 that are known to cause human disease. Historically in this country, in the United States, we have typically had disease due to serogroups A and C, and I guess a not too distant third, serogroup B. Serogroup Y and W135 have more often been prevalent in the continent of Africa and in parts of the Middle East. You may have read in the previous history accounts of the Hajj pilgrimage, where there is sometimes an outbreak of meningococcal disease. Many times that was due to serogroup Y and W135. So presumably, at some point, that serogroup got reintroduced in a significant fashion here to the States, and we're now dealing with that as a cause of disease. It is covered by the vaccine products out there. And so an important adjunct of the answering this question is to ensure that our at-risk patients, meaning younger children who have perhaps splenic dysfunction or immunodeficiency or terminal complement deficiencies, absolutely require vaccinations, but being very mindful about immunizing our upcoming college freshmen before they head off to school and become one of the major risk factors for meningococcal disease. A couple important additional findings about the serogroup Y meningococcal outbreak, again coming from the CDC and based on data countrywide. The first thing is that the typical risk categories, such as I just said, college freshmen or immunocompromised patients with terminal complement deficiencies or splenic dysfunction, etc., those are not necessarily the patients who are being disproportionately affected and infected by a serogroup Y in this outbreak. Instead, it is people ages 30 to 60 years of age who have accounted for almost 2/3 of the cases reported from 2023 and now 2024 to date. Also, people of Black, either African Black or even West Indies Black heritage, account for 63% of all the cases, and people with HIV are accounting for 15%. So those would not be the classic, certainly not the board's question, risk factors for meningococcal disease. Additionally, and importantly to the questioner's point, is that a fair number of the patients presenting with serogroup Y meningococcal disease are not presenting with meningitis, so they may not trigger that recognition bell like, oh, hey, wow, got to test for meninge and treat for meninge. Instead, they're presenting potentially with bacteremia, which again, almost 2/3, and at least 4% presented with, of all things, septic arthritis. Very interesting in that Neisseria as a general species includes Neisseria meningitidis, caused meningococcus, but also Neisseria gonorrhea, And Neisseria gonorrhea is known to cause gonococcal arthritis, especially in patients sexually acquired Neisseria gonorrhea disease who have disseminated gonococcal infection, in which they'll typically present with petechiae, fever, toxicity, malaise, and then typically a hot joint, most often a hot knee. Very similar to what's now being reported with serogroup Y meningococcal disease. So what do we look out for? Well, obviously the patients with classic presentation meningitis, we should be already thinking of meningococcus along with pneumococcus, H flu, and I guess also herpes as a possible cause of that disease. But increasingly, that patient presenting with fever, toxicity, a petechial and or purpuric rash, and certainly those findings with a hot joint, like especially a hot knee, we should absolutely be thinking about meningococcus as a possible source of that patient's illness. As of today here in the United States, the meningococcal strains remain susceptible to ceftriaxone. That is not true in other parts of the world, in which there have now been reported rates of cephalosporin resistance, and even, unfortunately, in some cases, fluoroquinolone resistance to cipro and levofloxacin antibiotics. So at least here, our empiric management for a patient with fever, presumed sepsis, and or presumed bacterial meningitis should be adequately covered with the doses of ceftriaxone. Okay, wow, great case, and I'm sure we've not seen the last of this yet, and certainly the epidemiologic predictive models are still being worked out as we get more information from the CDC and from national epidemiologic trends. Okay, next question. New data release shows that there's been a sudden rise in long COVID cases, otherwise known as post-acute COVID syndrome or a couple other monikers. Why do I think this is? Well, first of all, so again, as of just end of March, 6.8 Americans recently reported having long COVID, and that gives to a total of 17.6% of Americans who report long COVID at some point in time. Now, very importantly, this may help us address this question, where do these reports come from? And it is typically surveys to the patients, which are questioning them about symptoms and or self-diagnosis. So this is not being keyed to ICD-10 codes or healthcare provider models or sampling health insurance data at all. This is all personal report by patients themselves. And so you can imagine that there is almost definitely going to be a reporter bias in that data. So we need to question the new data, especially because it comes from the American Family Survey in large part, with just a little bit of question and maybe a slight, small, like, large rock of salt. However, that also being said, why are people reporting symptoms and or self-diagnosis of long COVID? Because the awareness of that as an entity and the association and the science relating it to prior infection with SARS-CoV-2 is now far more overt and far more readily accessible to the person in the general population. So I think we're seeing an apparent surge sort of as an epidemiologic phenomenon, in part because people are reporting, but more importantly, because they're becoming aware that such an entity as long COVID does exist and that it can develop after a primary infection, which may or may not be all that symptomatic. So I think then that may drive the apparent increase. There is nothing that has changed in terms of the sub-Omicron variant of SARS-CoV-2 out there in terms of re-triggering or re-causing a higher rate of long COVID. The actual rate, such as it can be, has not apparently changed when you actually look at healthcare reporting data. And certainly, as we better understand the immunologic model, which puts patients at risk for long COVID, the data and the science behind that has not changed either. It remains a hyperimmune response, likely due to molecular mimicry between the SARS-CoV-2 antigenic structure, whether it's spike protein or another component, which then causes almost like innocent bystander damage to all these supporting cells surrounding the neurons, such as the microglial cells, even some of the other like structural support cells. So one gets localized inflammation within neurologic tissue due to a triggered autoimmune response by the virus itself. And there is likely to be, although not yet fully understood, genetic predisposition to that and or just HLA typing or something like that, which puts patients at risk for developing long COVID. That is not something which is going to change, certainly not change with what we now know about ongoing mutations of the Omicron subvariants. And if it does, then I think we will truly see a large increase in reported cases coming from the healthcare industry. And so far, that has not been true. It's just been much better published and reported. Okay, next question. Do I predict the RSV vaccine will be available for more age groups next respiratory virus season? I don't think that we'll see a major change in the age-based indications for the nirsevimab and other monoclonal antibody products which may be coming down the pipeline. Certainly, I hope we will see far better availability and awareness of need for vaccine. And RSV, again, interestingly, unlike SARS-CoV-2 and COVID, RSV continues to strike fear into the hearts of parents and, well, I guess those children who are aware, much more so than COVID-19 really ever has, in at least in America. And so driving requests for vaccination, requests for passive immunity, which is what that is, have been a steady process here in the States. And yet, unfortunately, as we all well know, the availability of the product, nirsevimab, was quite limited. So that, at least in the next respiratory virus season, we should be much better positioned to deliver the passive immunity vaccination for those who wish it. I don't think, though, that we will see any major increases in the age-based approvals for that, because they're already quite broad as it is. Certainly the up to 8 months, you know, for the infants, any infant, makes a lot of sense. And then for those in their second year of RSV exposure with the risk factors such as we know, so chronic lung disease, chronic cardiac disease, etc., those I think will remain quite in place. What will remain to be determined, and it's going to be too early yet to tell in the next year, is should the older age group be broadened as well? Like, should our less than one-year-old babies and then the up to two-year-old children be immunized twice in their early lifetime? And it's not clear until we get post-vaccination data that that provides clinical benefit or that that's necessary. So hard to predict how that's going to shake out. I don't think that we'll have enough data based on this most recent RSV season and the babies we were able to immunize to drive any significant recommendation changes for age groups coming up. Maybe a year from next year, so maybe two seasons away, but don't quote me on that. We'll see how that turns out. The last question was originally a specific question about a patient management issue, but I'm going to extend that into a more general topic, which is critically important, and that has to do with the increasing rates of both invasive group A strep and also post-infectious streptococcal reactions like acute rheumatic fever. So the original question was about a patient who presented with Sydenham's chorea and confirmation of group A strep infection, both by rapid strep and then serology, and would that be sufficient to make a diagnosis of rheumatic fever and to start the penicillin or antibiotic prophylaxis? And the answer for all that is yes, 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 and yes. So when you look at the Jones criteria, and I'll just go ahead and give them to you right now, Jones criteria for rheumatic fever, there are both major and minor criteria. The major criteria, this is, I'm sure, bringing back all of our fun memories from medical school, major criteria are pancarditis, which basically be any part of the heart which has inflammation, whether it's pericarditis, endocarditis, myocarditis, or all three together. So that is the first major criteria. The second is polyarthritis. And here we're not talking just joint pain, but true, like, you know, a warm, indurated, painful joint or joints. And it could be a migratory polyarthritis, but the key here is it's not arthralgia only. It's not just pain, but it's actually evidence of inflammation. So that's major criteria number two. Number three are the subcutaneous nodules. Number four, the erythema marginatum, the classic rash. And number five is Sydenham's chorea. And then there are minor criteria, which are fever, well, shocker, that's, you know, it's in the name, arthralgias, a prolonged PR interval on the EKG, an increased inflammatory marker, whether it's a sed rate or C-reactive protein, and leukocytosis, so an elevated white blood cell count. To make a diagnosis of rheumatic fever requires either two major criteria or one major and two minor criteria, in the setting of also having proven recent or active strep disease. So there needs to be throat culture or rapid strep or an elevated ASO titer or anti-DNSB or something like that. The one exception to that rule, though, is Sydenham's chorea. So if the patient presents with what is called or diagnosed as Sydenham's chorea, that all by itself, especially with an evidence of group A strep infection, is sufficient for diagnosis of rheumatic fever. And then one would definitely start the antibiotic prophylaxis. If the patient is not having any cardiac involvement, then that antibiotic prophylaxis will last either, 5 years from time of diagnosis or 21 years of age, whichever is longer. So basically, you can just plan on the child getting prophylaxed, or young adult or whomever, up at least until age 21 in the absence of carditis. If they do have carditis, many recommendations are to continue that antibiotic prophylaxis for life or up into the 40s or so, and depending on what's happening with that cardiac disease, what it was it valvular, was it inflammatory, or et cetera. So definitely be on the lookout for rheumatic fever. We are seeing an increase of not just the invasive group A strep cases, as talked about on a previous podcast, but especially the post-infectious ones like scarlet fever. Had two of those over the weekend, rheumatic fever, two actually in the last week, and also post-streptococcal glomerulonephritis, a post-strep GN, which similarly can come from a streptococcal pharyngitis, but increasingly recognized to potentially come from group A strep skin infection. So a patch of cellulitis, a patch of impetigo, those are patients who are also at risk for developing post-strep glomerulonephritis. So very important, and thanks to the questioner for raising this issue, because we are going to continue to see an increased number of patients with group A streptococcal disease, whether it's active, primary, invasive, or post-infectious. The invasive group A strep continues to be pneumonia with empyema, musculoskeletal infections like osteomyelitis, necrotizing fasciitis, septic arthritis, severe cellulitis with phlebitis and bacteremia or sepsis, and a whole host of other things. So group A strep is out there along with all the fun viruses about which we usually talk. So there you go. That's a fair amount, a hodgepodge of infectious diseases topics. And thank you as always for listening to ID Talk. Arizona AAP members can submit questions for future episodes to covid@azaap.org. The Arizona AAP would like to acknowledge the generous support of this podcast by the Arizona Department of Health Services through the Title V Maternal and Child Health Services Block Grant funding. For more information and resources related to COVID-19 in Arizona and other infectious disease and infection prevention topics, and or to learn how to become a member, please visit us at azaap.org. And in the meantime, and as always, keep hanging in there and fighting a good fight. Thank all of you for your service, and know that everyone on the patient side and your colleague side appreciates all of you. Thanks again, folks.